This is On Being's Unheard Cuts. I'm Krista Tippett. You're listening to my unedited conversation with Geshe Thupten Jinpa. He's the Dalai Lama's primary English translator, and he's president of the Institute of Tibetan Classics in Montreal, Canada. I spoke with him on October 18th, 2010, at Emory University in Georgia. This interview is included in our show, Translating the Dalai Lama. View video footage of this conversation and download the MP3 of that produced show at onbeing.org.
Yeah, we can let him be on. And we'll do this.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And I got those starter needs.
I think we should go ahead and start.
Okay.
2 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just if it's
going to
take too long.
Chris,
did
you leave
the cell phone off?
Yes.
Did
anybody
as well?
Yeah, I think I did. Yeah. Even just. Not on silent, but off, because text messages come in and can...
No, I've switched it off. It's off.
Yeah, thank you.
I think you must have an incredibly grueling schedule when you're...
Yeah, when it's solidness, I mean, yes. With him, it's the concentration that mm-hmm. takes up a fair bit of energy. Because you never know when it's going to switch into Tibetan or...
Yeah. I was also at the Vancouver event back in October.
Yeah,
I never met
you,
Ricard, there. Just last year, though.
Yeah, that's true.
And so I watched one event after the other, one panel discussion after the other. It was exhausting just to observe that.
Yeah.
But we have a lot of people in common, and I've had quite a few people on the show who've been part of the Mind-Life Dialogues.
Oh, okay.
Matthew and Arthur Zions, John Kabat-Zinn, and Joan Halifax.
Yes,
you probably know.
Yes,
I don't know.
I know her, yeah.
And also Penny George. Do you know Penny? It's one of the... She's a benefactor, I think, of the Mind-Life Dialogue.
She's one of
our funders.
Okay.
Do you have any questions of me about...
Not really. I mean, other than to request you to simply call me Jinpa. That's my first name.
All right. I did know that everyone calls you Jinpa. And Down. She's somebody who told me when I was... I saw her. I was speaking out in Sun Valley, and she said, you must interview Jinpa. You must. But I'd heard that from others as well. Yeah, so we will hold this to an hour.
Sure.
Because I know you're tired. Yeah. And actually, I'm tired too.
Yeah, that would be helpful. Yeah.
Do we have the... Oh, here's the clock. Okay. Trent, how are we doing? We had the live stream up, and it just went down, of course, right before you arrived. So, Trent, do you think you need a minute or two, or can we...
You can go ahead.
Okay. I'll just say that the way I conduct these conversations is to try to speak not just about religion or spirituality, but about how these things infuse different lives.
Sure.
And also I like to say that we walk the line between great religious ideas and real experience, theology and human life. And that's a line I'm walking away. So I would like to start just with the background of your life, with your childhood, which is fairly dramatic. And I know that you were too young to remember that flight from Tibet that you went on with your parents and following His Holiness. But I wonder if that that exile, if you grew up with a sense from that experience what Tibetan Buddhism meant, or a sense of a special responsibility to this tradition because of that life experience?
I think growing up as a kid, I mean, I actually, looking back, I don't think I can say exactly when this sense of responsibility kind of dawned on me. But, I mean, I remember, although I don't recall my experience from a very, very early age, but I do have perhaps one of my earliest memories from my childhood was from this boarding school, which was in Simla, in North mm-hmm. India. It was actually, it turned out later, I found out, it was being administered and run by Save the Children's Fund, which is a British charity.
And it was a Tibetan children's?
It was established, specifically set up for Tibetan children's, mm-hmm. as a Tibetan children's village. But it was a smallish school. Later on, I found out it was, you know, because there were few non-Tibetan and non-Indian kind of, you know, teachers there. One of my earliest memories is really the visit of His Holiness to this school. And I remember this very vividly because a whole host of Indian security officials came, policemen, a couple of hours earlier. Could have been day earlier. And I remember playing marbles with them. That I remember very, very clearly.
Right.
Another thing that I remember very clearly is, you know, how it was a big deal for the mm-hmm. school, you know. And fortunately, a boy and a girl was chosen to offer him traditional Tibetan white scarf, and I happened to be chosen as the boy. I don't know why, but... So I remember that very vividly. And I also remember, you know, after His Holiness had this ceremony and we were walking, you know, from one place to another, you know, across the the entrance outside. I remember actually walking, holding his hand. I mean, I don't remember what I asked him, but so these are the very early memories I have. And I mean, one thing looking back, although, you know, from one point of view, I mean, from a conventional kind of point of view, it was not an ideal childhood. You know, I was at boarding school at the age of 4 and a half, separated from my parents. And so one could say it was not an ideal childhood. But on the other hand, my memories of my early childhoods are, on the whole, very, very positive. I remember being kind of well cared for. I remember this having this wonderful, warm sense of community. And the teachers, we had particularly two monks who were part of the staff. And they were just absolutely gorgeous. I remember, you know, the warmth, and even their faces looked kind of radiant, you know, to a kid's eye. So these are the kind of very, very early memories I have.
I wonder what what place His Holiness had in your imagination, even from that young age. You know, looking in from the outside, he is such a complex... There are all these aspects to what he represents and who he is, right?
Sure.
On the one hand, he's a national figure of the Tibetan people.
Sure.
On the other hand, he is a reincarnated Lama. On the other hand, he is, as he likes to say, a simple Buddhist monk.
Sure.
Did you think of him as human, divine? I mean, can you put that into words? Because I don't think there's an equivalent in
I think it's very
West.
Difficult to really kind of fully articulate the complexity of, you know, a Tibetan, someone like myself. Even after all these years of working for him so closely, to really describe the full range of the complexity of, you know, my relationship with him and my perception of him. Even at a very, very early age, I remember very, very clearly that there was, on my part, a tremendous kind of, you know, a sense of connection with him. I mean, I don't know why. Maybe, you know, as a kid, I saw him as a father figure, or, you know, and partly, you know, he's got this wonderful smile, mm-hmm. and which probably for a young kid is very comforting. Growing up later as a monk in a monastic university, then, of course, I had the opportunity to appreciate the more kind of, you know, sophisticated aspects of his personality as someone who has gone through the classical Buddhist education, someone who is a deep thinker, as, you know, erudite in the, you know, the most subtle aspects of technical Buddhist philosophy and mm-hmm. textual scholarship and all of this. Then later, as I began to work for him, you know, then of course I was able to, you know, of course, you know, as Tibetans, we there is a kind of a mythic dimension to our relation to His Holiness, because He's not just an individual person. You know, He kind of represents a whole institution of the Dalai Lama. And in a sense, we, you know, at some subconscious level, in the person of the Dalai Lama, we kind of bring together all the inherited wisdoms of the successive Dalai Lamas. And so there is that mythic aspects of, you know, at least, you know, my perception of him, which brings a certain richness. And then later, of course, you know, I had the opportunity and honor to be able to serve him, you know, much more closely as his personal translator. And then, of course, you know, what particularly impressed me most is the extent to which, you know, he goes to really care for the world. You know, I mean, he is truly there as you know, you read about the descriptions of the Bodhisattva in the scriptures, but it's very rare you see one. But when you see someone like him whose entire being is dedicated to the welfare of other sentient beings and who does it day in and day out. And so that was for me very, very, very inspiring, actually. I mean, much more so than his sophisticated, refined philosophy.
And you weren't actually trained as a translator, right? I mean, there looks kind of accidental you became translator. Sure. Tell me that story.
Well, actually, this was in 1985. I was a young monk, a typical young monk student in one of the large monastic universities, and these tend to be in the southern Indian state of Karnataka, where there are very large Tibetan settlements, and most of the monastic institutions, which were academic centers of learning in Tibet in the past, were reestablished in these South Indian settlements. So I was a student in one of those monasteries, actually called Ganden. And I happened to go to Dharamsala because my brother and sister were studying there at that time. And then it so happened that His Holiness was scheduled to give a series of teachings, and the official translator who was supposed to be interpreting for these teachings were not in residence, but and the teaching was organized by a Buddhist group from Los Angeles. So they were looking for someone to stand in for this interpreter on the first day. So one thing led to another. The word spread around that there is this young monk who speaks good English. And
you've been to Cambridge by that time?
No, I haven't. Right. Yeah, I haven't. Yeah. So, and then I was approached and I said, look, you know, I haven't done any translation professionally. I don't think I can do it, and I'm too terrified. And so one thing led to another. I ended up doing it, but it was fortunately a simultaneous translation through the FM radio. So it's less, it's less kind of unnerving because you can be anonymous. So fortunately, the text he was teaching was something that I was quite familiar with. And then the next day, the interpreter turned up, and then His Holiness saw, and he said, well, there are two of you, why don't you switch? So we started switching, and then the request came from the Western students who were there saying, you know, it's very confusing to switch between two styles, can the first translator do it? So I told my colleague, I said, look, why don't I do the first 3 days, and when the next part of the teaching begins, you take over. So anyway, I ended up doing the whole thing. But during that time, on the third day, the secretary called me up and he said, His Holiness is curious about you. You know, he wants to see you. And so he asked me some background. And then so the next day there was, I had a meeting with the audience with His Holiness. And His Holiness looked at me and said, I know you. You are a good scholar. You're a good debater. But he said, I never associated your face with someone who spoke English. And he was kind of slightly intrigued. He said, how come I didn't know about you, you know? So, and then he said, people tell me that you have a very accessible style of speaking, and would you be willing to, you know, come with me, you know, every now and then if I need some translation services? Of course, I cried there. And, you know, I said, you know, never even in my dream I ever thought that I'd be able to serve you in such capacity. I said, of course. So that was in 1985, and then I started basically
traveling. That is kind of a lovely circle, though, when you talk about him visiting the monastery, right? And you
hold
his hand, and then those years later, you end up. You know, I would like to talk to you, I mean, just even with this image you just gave of debating in monasteries, and didn't you enter a monastery at the age of 11, is that right?
Yes.
And you are a scholar, you were in a ritual monastery and later a scholastic monastery. And that's a whole layer of Tibetan Buddhism that is unknown in the West, and also there's no space for that to find expression in the Dalai Lama's public appearances.
Sure.
So I would like to draw you out a little bit on that. I mean, I think even there's a lot of interest, fascination about the mind-life dialogues and the scientific research on the brains of meditators.
Sure.
But even what comes across about that is just such a small slice. And I know you've written about this too. You know, as you say, that His Holiness belongs to this, and you belong to this vast, ancient, rich, in part very esoteric, metaphysical world. And I wonder if we could if you would take us just a little way inside that, a little farther inside. I mean, just for starters, for example. I mean, we don't have to go too far. But for example, I mean, you've pointed out that meditation is an English word, and that the word meditation that everyone knows now, in fact, doesn't carry all of the nuance.
Sure.
So talk about just linguistically, you know, how you would start opening that up a little bit to the complexity, you know.
I mean, like, in some ways, when you see terms like meditation become popularized, it sort of becomes a victim of its own success.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that it gets to be popularized means it has become mainstream, but on the other side, you have to pay a price for this.
Mm-hmm.
So going mainstream involves some process of kind of reduction where it sort of somehow ends up in this lowest denomination. So in the popular image, people tend to immediately think of meditation as someone sitting quietly, emptying the mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I once remember actually seeing a comic strip, and in one frame of the, you know, drawing, there was a person sitting down and meditating, and in the other frame, a friend comes by and he says, "What are you doing?" And he says, "I'm meditating." And in the third frame, and the guy who says, "What does it do?" And the response is, "It empties your mind, you know, you empties your mind, your thoughts." And then in the final frame, he says, "Well, I thought your mind was pretty empty of thought to begin with."
Right.
So there's that kind of connotation. But if you look at the original Sanskrit term, bhavana, and the Tibetan term, gom, from which this term meditation has been kind of being used now as a translation, bhavana and Tibetan term gom, bhavana has the connotation of cultivation. It's like cultivating a field. So there is this connotation of cultivation, and the Tibetan term gom has the connotation of familiarity, a process of familiarity.
Right.
So the idea is a kind of it points to some kind of reflective exercise that involve an element of repetitive process,
mm-hmm.
but in a disciplined manner, to a in a focused way. So and meditation can be, you know, as His Holiness often points out, analytic, where it's not simply sitting down and quieting your mind, but it can actually be a process where you use kind of discernment and move from stages and stages to kind of, in some sense, uncovering layers and layers.
So there's
to a
knowledge
point.
That's being
yes,
acquired.
Exactly. So it's kind of an analytic process, but also meditation can be, you know, simply stilling the mind. So basically, there tend to be two main styles of meditation. One is more of a kind of a focused, single-pointed, stilling the mind, where the effect is more of reaching to a calm state.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have the other style of meditation, which is more aimed at kind of penetrating deeper and deeper into, and you know, understanding the interconnections and implications and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, when we use in the popular English context, we use the word meditation, all of these nuances get left out. But it's probably part of the process, and at some point, the nuances will come back. Because in the end, I agree with the famous Wittgensteinian dictum that, you know, the meaning of a word is its use. Mm. So the meanings comes to acquire through usage.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the notion of emptiness, I mean, you've written about, tell me about the knowledge that comes through meditation. What?
Well, it's not simply, the Tibetan tradition, you know, is a very complex tradition. Mm-hmm. And in some sense, you know, one of the main things that people have to bear in mind is that when people are kind of encountering a tradition such as Tibetan Buddhism, it's very different historically from, say, any of the monotheistic traditions that you see. In the West, particularly in the West, through history, through a process has taken place where there has been a kind of a gradual separation between spirituality or religion, or soteriology, which is a system of thought that has some notion of salvation,
right,
on the one hand, and philosophy, which has more to do with kind of understanding concepts and their interrelations, and then you have science, which has even mm-hmm. further kind of, you know, now confining more and more to a worldview where your understanding of the world is based on what you can directly perceive, or what you can infer on the basis of what direct experience can show us. Mm-hmm. So this kind of separation between science and philosophy and spirituality has not occurred in the context of Tibetan tradition, mm-hmm. Tibetan Buddhism. So Tibetan Buddhism is kind of an entire worldview. Now, because of that, you know, you cannot look at Tibetan Buddhism and say this is religion. You can, for the same reason, you cannot say this is philosophy, mm-hmm. or nor can you say this is science. Of course, certainly not. Mm-hmm. But within that tradition, you have all the elements. So a monk's training involves kind of incorporating all of this, integrating all of this. And because, unlike, say, secular forms of humanism or, you know, kind of secular philosophy, even in the context of Buddhist philosophy, because it was never divorced from soteriology, philosophy is never done for its own sake.
Right.
Philosophy is done for the sake of something else. Mm-hmm. So philosophy, you know, philosophical inquiry is driven by some kind of understanding of, you know, kind of ethical motivation and aimed at some kind of spiritual goal of, you know, enlightenment, mm-hmm. or whatever you may want to call it, perfection. So that makes the training of a monk very, very sophisticated, because you have to, you know, kind of study all these aspects. So that's why, scholastic monastic education include a very rigorous course in what, from an average, you know, kind of educated person point of view, are very esoteric, mm-hmm. you know, questions of philosophy, you know, epistemology, the relationship between our perception and the world, and the distinction between true knowledge and a mere belief and assumption. Mm-hmm. You know, how does a language and thought relate to the actual reality? Is the relationship between our terms and the object they refer to kind of a referential, or whether they mean, you know, the relationship is, you know, emerges in the context of a much more complex relationship of some kind of coherent theory of truth? I mean, these are right. very, very esoteric questions. But the monks who go through scholastic training, you know, through debate, through dialectics, you know, look at all of this. And then the basic standpoint is fairly, kind of, one could say, Socratic. Mm-hmm. The idea that in the end, it is knowledge that liberates. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, Buddhism is, you know, the basic motto is very similar to the Socratic principle, knowledge right. liberates. This is a very old idea, not just in the East, but also mm-hmm. in the West.
But there is that link that, you're right, has been severed, decoupled in the West between knowledge and goodness.
Sure.
Or knowledge, yes. Let's just leave it at that. Knowledge
sure.
and goodness.
Yeah.
I think that's one way that the Dalai, that His Holiness talks about it.
Exactly.
And that is, although, as we've been saying, what people may learn of Buddhism or initially know about it is perhaps a simplified idea about meditation, I also think it is that connection, that reconnection between knowledge and goodness that
sure.
that is magnetic to
sure.
people.
Sure.
You've also said that the Tibetan tradition then provides a novel response to this ancient Greek question of why knowledge doesn't translate into action. I mean, and what you just said helps explain that in fact that things are never separated to begin with.
Sure, partly that, but also partly in the Eastern tradition. It's not just Tibetan tradition, but also Indian tradition, in classical Indian tradition in general. There was always the role for meditation. And meditation can be seen as a kind of the link mm-hmm. between kind of intellectual conscious knowledge and its translation into behavior. And the transitional link is provided by what could be called bhavana or cultivation or meditation.
Cultivation, right.
Yeah.
Right.
So the idea is you can begin with knowledge, but knowledge needs to be totally integrated into the being, into the very personality of the person, so that what comes out in response to a given situation would be something that is ethical, truly ethical, and the right thing to do. But in order for the knowledge to have that kind of expression, that knowledge needs to be, I mean, to use a modern computer language, needs to be completely processed.
Mm.
So, and that processing of that is what allows integration of that knowledge into your being, so that it becomes almost like a second nature. I mean, you know, learning how to drive is a very, very good example. I mean, I can say this because I started driving quite late, you know, because in India I never learned how to drive. And so, and you know, at the beginning it is tough. You have to remember everything. You have to remember to look in the mirror. You have to but after a while it just becomes a second nature to you. Mm-hmm. You know, you can drive effortlessly. You know, you can talk. I mean, of course, you shouldn't be speaking on the phone or watching something, but at least right. you can have a decent conversation with someone and you know, it becomes effortless. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of idea, that knowledge at the initial stage needs to be acquired through conscious deliberation.
Mm-hmm.
But that knowledge acquiring once isn't enough to change you. But in order to have a behavioral effect, the change at the level of behavior, that knowledge needs to be somehow integrated. And that integration can be achieved through a process which we will call cultivation or meditation.
I mean, I think of meditation as a spiritual technology. It's interesting
yes,
that you
yeah.
use that computer
yeah.
term. And prayer also, I think, can be
yes,
a spiritual
yes.
technology.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, my colleague, Professor Robert Thurman, from Columbia University, he uses the term technology.
Does
yeah,
he?
Yeah.
I wonder, in your, like, as someone who entered a monastery at a young age and lived in this tradition for many, many years, you've lived in this tradition all your life, and you were a monk for many years. Is there a moment that you can recall where you were aware of that transition from working at it to the effortlessness?
I think it's, I mean, this process one needs to go through in relation to a lot of things. So mm-hmm. I don't think you can achieve this in relation to one and then somehow you can kind of generalize in all the domains.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I mean, there I was talking more in relation to a particular form of knowledge.
Right.
But one incident, it really is the debating skill, and it is a dialectic process. Initially, it's a very conscious, deliberate process where you have to learn all the moves.
And this is within the monastery, the debates.
Yeah, mm-hmm. monastery. And it's the primary medium of study, actually, because it's, I mean, looking back from Cambridge, when I went to study there finally, you know, then looking back from my experience as a Cambridge student to my monastic years, I mean, one day I was kind of laughing because in the Western context, when you was, you know, I did my course in philosophy at Cambridge, mm-hmm. you know, silence is what you expect. You're in the library, nobody's talking. Even if someone whispers, right. someone says, quiet, quiet. So this is the main medium in the West is through reading and kind of, you know, studying in that manner. But in the Tibetan tradition, although reading is important, but the primary medium is really debate. And the debating courtyards are, of course, the loudest place. Now, there are literally right. hundreds of students. One, you know, and each, you know, the whole group divided into a pair, one sitting down who's defending a thesis or responding, and the one standing up who's questioning and attacking the position. And every time a point is made by the questioner, he claps his hands and, you know, stamps his left foot. And it's very loud, and it's actually quite a boisterous gesture as well. So you could see the contrast. Mm-hmm. And there is an understanding in the Tibetan tradition that much of the insights needs to arise in the dialogical context. It's a kind of a different way of looking at in a kind of birth of knowledge.
And I think that's very different from what most people would imagine when you say the word monastery,
yes,
even
yeah.
more than library. That's
sure.
where people would imagine
sure,
silence.
Sure. So I mean, there is a saying that the students should honor their classmates as much as they honor their teacher, because just as the teacher who's giving the lecture. It's important for your knowledge. So are your colleagues with whom you debate. So you may have a whole group of students who, you know, each of them don't fully know, but in the course of, I mean, this is a bit like, today we call it brainstorming.
Yes, it
I mean,
is.
It's a bit like brainstorming.
Yes, yes.
But in a much more, so there, the debating art itself, fortunately, I was able to master it very fast, but tend to take fairly long, but once you and the mastery of that skill then makes everything much easier, because then you know in the course of debating you no longer rely on the formula that you have learned, but you're able to now kind of, there's an element of spontaneity that arises,
mm-hmm.
so that you know you can get yourself onto a mental plane where even though there are many other classmates shouting and but you can maintain your total focus, and because you're at this kind of very high plane of mental state, mm-hmm. kind of, you know, there's a certain swiftness that arises in the context of engaging, you know, back and forth.
It is also a nimbleness of mind
yeah.
that, as
yeah,
you say, comes
a certain
with exercise.
Flexibility, yeah.
So just give me an example of what a topic might be.
Well, we begin, the monk students start with a very mundane topics of, you know, kind of, say, for example, the relationship between the concept of color and a white color. So anything that is a white color is necessarily, you know, subsumed by the concept of color, but there are colors which are not white, and there are things which are neither of the two. Then you can take another example of relationship between, say, a Tibetan and a monk. So then it gets a bit more complicated. So there are people who are both Tibetan mm-hmm. and a monk, but then there are Tibetans who are not monks. Then there are monks who are not Tibetans, and then there are people who are neither of the two. So then you can see, so you start building these kind of relationships. So so this is taught very early to kids to really start learning to play with concepts and their relationships. And in this way, you train.
And again, that is all about the totality of
yeah.
human experience, bringing
yeah.
together these spheres that are somewhat separate in
sure.
the West of
sure.
scientific knowledge, philosophical knowledge, moral
sure.
training. So, you know, one thing that this helps me understand, actually, is, as I said, as I remarked before, the His Holiness the Dalai Lama's public teachings are very simple.
Yes.
Of necessity, and yet he carries this weight and authority that transcends the words.
Sure.
And so what this helps me understand, and I was realizing this as I was reading you also in preparation for this, is the experience of him is not just of the stripped down teachings, but of the fruit of the teachings.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Of the cultivation.
Sure. Sure.
Of this very complex tradition.
Sure. Yeah. And I mean, in his case, one of the things about a very compelling thing about him is that when he talks about, you know, issues like compassion and sense of caring for others and recognition of the oneness of human family, mm-hmm. you know, there's a kind of a note of conviction that comes through partly through his body language.
Yes.
And that's why it's very powerful.
It's almost tangible.
Yeah, exactly.
As
it's
much
almost
as
kind
it's
of visceral. And the fact that he embodies these is what makes the interaction with him, even in these large public events, mm-hmm. very, very powerful. Mm-hmm. Because you can see the conviction with which he says it. And of course, partly because he wants to really reach everybody, there's a kind of a deliberate simplification of the message. But partly it's also because he insists on communicating directly mm-hmm. with the audience mm-hmm. that, you know, he relies on his own command of English. I mean, his vocabulary is very rich, but then his ability to carry on with complex sentences mm-hmm. becomes more challenging. But at the same time, he likes to engage with people just directly, you know, especially in the public, large public events,
yes.
public talks. So it comes out sometimes, if you listen to him for the first time, somewhat simplistic. But on the other hand, if you dwell on what he's trying to say carefully, they're actually quite profound. For example, his argument that, you know, the basic human nature is more inclined towards goodness and compassion. And, you know, he builds this up by giving all sorts of arguments, folks, one of which is the fact that when we were born, affection was the most dominant force mm-hmm. without which we couldn't survive. And the fact that we have the ability to appreciate others' affection, which means we must have some capacity to show it to others. And also, you know, citing from scientific research, making the connection with our evolutionary kind of ancestors, with the animal world. So the kind of biological nature of our being. So if you kind of sit down and think through, I mean, when you sit there and listen to him, it all seems very, you know, kind of common sense. But on the other hand, I would argue that it's the commonsensical nature of his general talk that is most profound, because in a sense he's making us think and not take for granted these things. For example, like one of the kind of memorable things he has said is that the fact that, you know, the kind of actions of affection, actions of love and care, caring, do not make headlines is mm-hmm. because we take them for granted.
Right, right.
Which suggests that we expect people
as normal to
mm-hmm. behave in that manner. Mm-hmm. The fact that killing and violence makes headlines is because mm-hmm. we don't expect normally people mm-hmm. to behave in that manner.
Yes,
and
but
when
our,
they do, we are shocked.
We and become very confused.
Exactly. And he is suggesting that by not being critically reflective, we sometimes let ourselves driven by headline news. Mm-hmm. And the sad casual kind of, you know, byproduct of that is that people become cynical, thinking that, oh, we're such a horrible species. Mm-hmm. Whereas he's saying that this is the opposite. The fact that they are sensational, that they are news-making, means that somehow, in some way, we don't expect fellow human beings to behave in those manners. Mm-hmm. So these kind of things are very powerful, actually. I mean, it's he's questioning many of our everyday assumptions, and he's saying, no, don't take them for granted.
Mm-hmm. I've been involved in different ways in the mind-life dialogues, I believe, which are this extended dialogue that sure. His Holiness has hosted between scientists and spiritual thinkers. And I think that, on this program, certainly we've drawn out some of the scientific learnings from that.
Sure.
And also spoken with people who have a scientific as well as a spiritual perspective, like Arthur Zients and Jon Kabat-Zinn. But, I'd like to know, you've been involved in those as well, and you know what they've shown about how meditation does affect the brain. And, the research that's come out of that has really changed neuroscience, which is very, sure. very full of impact. But how have those conversations and the learnings through them affected you? Have they opened your mind up to knowing or thinking about things that you hadn't considered before?
Well, it's difficult to say. I had been fortunate to be part of the Mind and Life dialogues right from the beginning when it began. One thing it has changed my mind is probably perhaps the way, as a Buddhist scholar, today I look at many of the mental processes. Mm. Before I encountered kind of mind and life dialogues and had the chance to kind of, be part of this ongoing long dialogue, my entire training is in Buddhist philosophy. And even in the West, when I went to Cambridge, I did philosophy. So I was much more comfortable, thinking about these processes and phenomena purely at the philosophical level. Of course, as a Buddhist philosopher, we do acknowledge that there are behavioral expressions of your mental states. Mm-hmm. But the brain was never really part of that picture.
Mind.
Yeah, there's a mind, yes. And then there is mm-hmm. your behavior. Mm-hmm. And as a result of, being part of, in these dialogues, I've come to appreciate how the Western neuroscientific understanding of the brain's role in mental experience is fairly advanced. Hmm. And I've come to now, accept that no discourse on mental phenomena that doesn't take into account the brain's role is going to be complete and comprehensive. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, although I may not buy into completely the scientific agenda and the underlying assumption that in the end, all mental processes are reducible to
biology
mm-hmm. and brain biological or biochemistry mm-hmm. Or whatever it is, basically a physical processes, which I know is a major assumption underlying neuroscience and much of Western life sciences in general. One could argue that this is a regulative principle with which they operate. I, as a Buddhist thinker, I'm not convinced. Mm-hmm. My own feeling is that the problem of consciousness is going to remain. A philosopher called it the very hard problem. And I think, at least for the foreseeable future, it is mm-hmm. going to remain a very hard problem. Mm-hmm. I can't quite see how, in the end, consciousness can be ultimately reduced to brain processes. Now, having said that, I do agree, and here His Holiness too, agrees that many of our conscious mental processes, those can be understood and explained in terms of brain processes.
Right.
So there could be, both Buddhists and neuroscientists could make great strides by collaborating in researches that would look at specific aspects of the mental phenomena, whether it is attention, whether it is compassion, empathy, memory, mindfulness, basic awareness. I think a lot of these, in many of these very specific mental phenomena, I'm sure neuroscience will have a lot to say. They will make a huge amount of progress. And Buddhists, too, can learn a lot.
But there's also still a distinction, or you can ask the question in two ways, right? Whether there is a physical correlate to mental processes or even to what we call consciousness.
Yes.
Or whether they arise physically, whether they are purely physical phenomena.
Sure.
So, this is something I would have asked His Holiness the Dalai Lama, but would never have a chance to, and certainly not in this interfaith dialogue we were in yesterday. But, I mean, because of your belief in reincarnation, I mean, that sheds a whole new light on the matter of consciousness, right?
Sure.
Because
sure.
presumably he is a... Well, you say this, but there's a body, but there's something complete, in fact,
sure.
as you understand it, that
sure.
completely transcends the body and moves from one body to another.
Yes.
Do you think, is that a discussion in Tibetan circles?
Well, not in the mind and life circles. Because
no, but
His Holiness,
in response to the mind and life circles within Tibetan
yes,
tradition?
Yes, of course. I think... this is probably potentially an area where science and Buddhism may have kind of an important divergence.
Mm-hmm.
For Buddhism, it's very important to at least acknowledge the possibility of consciousness that is, although on the manifest level of experience, may be contingent upon the physical basis, which is the brain,
mm-hmm.
but at some ultimate level, there is a kind of an aspect of that our experience of consciousness that is independent. So, for example, the way in which Buddhist philosophy understands the relation, the kind of the distinction between a process that is material and a process that is psychological or mental, is that mental phenomena are thought to be characterized by subjectivity, subjective experience.
Mm-hmm.
That's, whereas the physical phenomena is characterized by some kind of extension in space, measurability, and quantifiability, as science would suggest. Whereas mental phenomena, are in some sense... their primary characteristic is this mere subjectivity of experience. And actually one Western philosopher has, coined this very famous term, what it feels like to be a bat. I mean, I even wrote a paper which was very influential. And the term is used among the Western philosophical circles called qualia. Qualia is that subjective experience of what it means to be conscious.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Buddhists would argue that is the defining ingredient of mental phenomena, which is what makes mental experience completely different from physical matter and processes.
Mm-hmm.
And that, in the end, cannot be explained purely in terms of material processes. Now, I know that some scientists try to account for this through quite a complex theory of what they call emergence. So how, and this is the idea that from simpler structures emerge more complex,
right.
systems, and
right.
from complex systems emerge even more complex systems. And a lot of the scientists would argue that consciousness is, in the end, some kind of emergent property that arises from these kind of
biological origins.
Yeah. So, I mean, here I think Buddhism probably would have divergence. But, I mean...
But it also diverges in the sense that you're taking subjectivity as seriously as physicality.
Yeah.
Right? And
sure.
saying that,
in fact, it is real and solid as what can be measured. It's as primary as material phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the argument.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as the current science is concerned, I mean, the jury's, out. Because at this point, there's even conceptually, you know, I mean, let alone, I mean, there being an actual description, but even, I mean, even conceptually, there is just simply no kind of, you cannot even imagine how can you give a physical account of a phenomena whose primary characteristics is this subjectivity.
Mm-hmm.
So the science, in order to really account for this, will have to go through radical, radical transformation.
Mm-hmm.
And so it probably will also need to include much greater kind of, you know, and probably quite some aspects of the methodology needs to be, for example, some people are arguing that science needs to bring back the role of first-person introspection.
Mm-hmm.
You know, psychology tried that at the turn of the 20th century and then dumped it, and then behaviorism took over, and mm-hmm. behaviorism became the dominant approach to psychology. But now people are beginning to argue, partly because of the emerging field of, you know, meditation science, people are beginning to argue that maybe we need to take a second look at the role of introspection, the first-person account,
mm-hmm.
in, you know, in understanding consciousness and mental processes. So unless, you know, at the moment, the scientific methodology is completely dominated by someone looking from outside. It's a third-person objective perspective.
Right.
You know, someone's looking from outside. And so in that kind of description, you know, no matter how detailed description you may give of the brain processes, what's mm-hmm. happening in this part of the brain, that part of the brain gets activated, these chemical processes are becoming active, and this is being fired, and there this electrical pulse. Or, in the end, none of these equate to the actual felt experience of that consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Right, and meditation and the complex layers of introspection is a first-person exploration,
yeah, exactly,
of the nature,
exactly,
of the mind.
Exactly.
And when you say consciousness, I mean, let's say again, if in terms of the idea of reincarnation, I mean, it's more than awareness. It's also aspects of memory, right? I mean, what,
yes,
do you think of? What is involved in human consciousness when you use that word?
I think at a fundamental level, consciousness, I mean, maybe the term consciousness, even in the English usage, there's a certain ambiguity. Sometimes mm-hmm. We refer to consciousness in the sense of being self-conscious.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes people would argue that animals like rats are not conscious because they have no self-consciousness. Yeah. But sometimes consciousness...
I'm not sure how we know that.
But yeah, exactly. But yeah, sometimes people tend to use consciousness in a much more general sense, as a way of contrasting consciousness from inanimate material object.
Right.
So therefore, the ambiguity
sentient.
Of the term, yeah,
mm-hmm.
sentient, ambiguity of the term exists in English as well as in the Tibetan equivalent. But to put it very crudely, by consciousness, in the Buddhist philosophy, we mean this primary phenomenon which give rise to all the more evolved conscious sensory and thought processes. So every instance of mental experience has consciousness as part of it. So consciousness can be seen as a kind of a primary awareness, which is a kind of a basic property of a sentient being. So now many of the more conscious part of that experience of mental life, say a specific memory mm-hmm. of a place or a person, or a very kind of, you know, technical knowledge of certain things, these are very contingent upon experience
mm-hmm.
of what you have.
Which may be rooted in a body,
yeah,
right?
Uh-huh. But the underlying that, all of this mental experience, is, to use kind of, you know, William James' terminology, a stream of consciousness. There is this kind of continuity
mm-hmm.
underlying all of this. And it is this stream that Buddhists would argue gets kind of, you know, carried over from life after life. And when it passes on, it goes on in a very, very rudimentary, basic level, but at the same time, it has all the capacity of expressing itself, you know, into a more evolved form of consciousness. So just because you have experienced something in this life doesn't mean that you're going to be able to remember everything in the next life.
But there might be some imprint of that.
Sure, sure.
Well, that's. I feel like I could talk about this for hours, but I promised to get you out of here in 10 minutes. I want to come back to this very, very human encounter that I have with you, this experience that many people have of you when they experience His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, as his translator. But I have to say, having observed that a few times in a few different places, it feels much more like an intimate conversation that's happening between the two of you. I've even heard people describe it like a marriage, that you're completing his thought before he finishes his sentence. You know, it's more than just you interpreting words. It feels like a friendship as well.
Sure.
You know, just going back to the story you told me about the awe you had for him, which I think that also comes through too, a great reverence comes through. But what is that like then, to develop that relationship with this person?
I think when I'm actually on stage assisting him as his interpreter, I actually kind of lose the sense of time. I mean, fortunately, because I've served in this capacity for now over 25 years, and also having worked so closely with him, and in many instances, it's not so much that he needs interpretation, but it's basically, you know, he's thinking about something and he starts a conversation, and my role is to simply follow through the, you know, kind of
follow that through chain that of thought to the end. Yes.
And then when he is struggling for a word, simply to suggest, so that his struggle for the word doesn't stop his flow of thought. And that has been primarily the kind of the role that generally in the public events, but I mean more technical nature, say like at science conference, then there will be a lot more interpretation. But I mean, in my case, because I've done this for so many years, I'll be hearing something that he had already said before. But every time he says it, he says it in a completely different way. It's very fresh, and the fact that, you know, he truly lives it, makes a huge difference. And the sheer joy of his personality, I mean, that person, that makes the experience very, very... I'm almost in a meditative state when I'm translating for him.
But it's a joyful meditative state in which there's laughter as well.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. I mean, I suppose perhaps I was fortunate enough to establish this close working relationship with him when I was in my monastic years. And perhaps there was a sense of collegiality, of kind of camaraderie, you know, kind of fellow monastic members. And in fact, when I finally left the order and met him as a lay person, the first thing he said to me was, of course, as a senior member of the monastic community, you know, you have to understand that I was very saddened to lose someone like you. And then he said, but at the same time, I know you well, and I know you have thought about this question very seriously, and you haven't taken this decision lightly. So he said, you know, I trust your judgment. So that's the person he is, and he's. I mean, it's interesting. What is interesting about His Holiness is that what are, you know, opposing characteristics in normal human beings, you tend to see them in a converging in him. Mm-hmm. Because normally, when you see among religious people, people who are pious, people who are very, very devoted and self-disciplined, they tend to be also quite intolerant of others who don't meet up to their standards. Mm-hmm. And I saw that particularly with His Holiness, that this was completely lacking. You know, mm-hmm. when I was a monk, I was never really pious. That was never my cup of tea. I was studious. I was, curious. But piety was never really my cup of tea. So, and His Holiness gets up at 3:30 in the morning. You know, I even have difficulty getting up at 5:30 or 6. So for a monk, that is fairly late. And but I never felt being judged by him. Mm-hmm. You know, even when I was a monk, that somehow I wasn't living up to the standards that a monk was expected to be, you know.
Right.
And so this is amazing thing about it. And another thing is that normally when you see people who have tremendous self-confidence, then humility is not really part of their characteristic. You know, there's with a powerful self-confidence comes a certain sense of pride and arrogance. Again, in His Holiness, mm-hmm. his arrogance is completely missing. He's at a personal level very humble, but at the same time, tremendous self-confidence.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So this is an interesting juxtaposition of what generally can be contrasting kind of, characteristics. And so these kind of things, and one of the things that amazes me is that he has this gift to be fully present, when he's talking to someone. And it doesn't really matter whether the person in the room that he's talking to is the president of a country or whether it is just an ordinary person. The way in which he treats has just none of these mundane considerations, have any role. And that is an amazing kind of quality, because it's very, very difficult. And another thing is that in him, people who, that Tibetans particularly, adore him,
right.
worship him, one could argue. But none of this goes to his head. He remains humble mm-hmm. at a personal level. So these are what makes it amazing for me to have this opportunity to work for him. Mm-hmm. after all these years, my affection for him, my admiration, my respect, mm-hmm. even my sense of awe remains undiminished.
Right. Can I ask you one more question?
Sure.
But I think we need to change tapes, right?
I
forgot. I was supposed to give them just one more question. I'm really...
Sure.
Do you have more work tonight?
Are
you...
Not really.
Okay, good. This is really wonderful. I really completely forgot until just then, because they have 1 hour on these tapes.
You're maximizing the life of these tapes.
Okay, good. Okay. I'm glad to do that. You tell me when. Okay. So you... are married now, right? When
yes,
you left
yeah.
the monastic order. So how long have you been married?
14 years now.
And you
yeah.
have two children,
two
is that
children,
right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I heard this, where did we read this? Anyway, in the when we were researching you, we found a question and answer with His Holiness, and someone asked him about anxiety and stress. And he said, well, even monks and nuns are caught in anxieties, and my advice is to live simply. And he said, my translator, Geshe Thupten Jinpa, can answer that question better. He was a monk, now he's a father. As a monk, he slept peacefully. Now as a father, his child wakes him up when he's asleep. I do wonder how... one thing that occurs to me is that maybe as a parent, you also have a different insight into the longings and the stresses that people bring
sure.
when they hear his teachings.
Sure.
And that this life, I mean, even I know I read about that he gets up at 3:30 and meditates for hours before sure. every day. That I have children do sure. that. It feels like a dream. How has that changed you, formed you, made you a different Tibetan Buddhist and a different colleague to His Holiness?
I think you are right. I mean, one thing that surprised me a bit was actually how challenging relationships can be, actually. you know, although as a monk, you know, we live in a community, there are relationships, but relationships are more that of teacher to student and to fellow monks, as you know, colleagues, and you know, then we have within the monastic community, the setup is we have smaller families within which we live together. But none of the the challenges that we have, you know, in any given social context where there are more than two or three people, there's always going to be some challenges in the context of relationships, because that's, you know, what we are, we're human beings. Mm-hmm. But what surprised me a little bit was how actually tougher it was to have actually a marriage really. Partner and to live in a truly, you know, sharing life. That was tougher. But on the other hand, I truly feel grateful that I went through the monastic life, because the discipline it taught me, and also, and it may sound strange, but a certain degree of emotional independence I found tremendously helpful.
As a married man.
As a married man, mm-hmm. so that you don't dump all of your baggage on your spouse. Mm-hmm. And somehow when your spouse is annoyed or angry, that somehow to be able to relate to that in a more compassionate manner so that you don't take it personally. Mm-hmm. So that, and also it has partly to do with the kind of compassion training that we go through in the monasteries that His Holiness was talking about today. This, you know, putting yourself in other people's shoes and trying to, you know, kind of enhance one's empathy. Mm-hmm. So these kind of things, you know, the best way I could describe this is some degree of emotional independence, so that you don't, it's, you know, your relationship is not completely, you know, this kind of needy and this clingy and grasping. Mm-hmm. So that I was very happy to see that, you know, that my monastic years really helped. Mm-hmm. And also this basic discipline, that I, as a monk, that I was able to bring into my life, that was... But at the same time, what was very, very valuable as a layperson is the sheer joy and also the headaches that comes with being a parent, you know. Mm-hmm. And His Holiness, of course, when he talks about cultivation of compassion, he says that because of the biological factor, you know, women are, you know, in some sense, have greater propensity and greater sensitivity to others' pain. Therefore, you know, there needs to be more women leaders, women in the public role, particularly in the leadership role. And so, you know, something similar to this is what I experienced as a father, that there is a certain visceral feeling of love and compassion to your children that as monks probably it will take ages to cultivate. Mm-hmm. That, you know, as parents, you know, these comes very naturally. And you can see that especially when the children are young, I mean, as they get, now my two girls are kind of teenage and preteen, so mm-hmm. it gets more complicated. But especially when they're very young, you know, their needs are very real, and their needs are very urgent, yes. and their needs are for now, you know. And so one thing I noticed is that in the parental love, the quality of unconditionality is very powerful. Mm-hmm. Whereas as a monk, you don't have that opportunity except towards your teacher. But then there is a kind of a hierarchy. You know, it's to someone who is an object of reverence.
Right. So this really gives you... an experience of an expression of these things you were learning in the monastery.
Oh, definitely. Especially the unconditionality mm-hmm. of, you know, this is truly selfless nature mm-hmm. of the parental love to your child. And this is powerful.
Mm-hmm. What comes to mind as the most unexpected and formative experiences you've had as translator? This is my last question. I always hate being asked that question about the best, the most interesting.
Well, that's one thing that I do cherish deeply about the experience of translating for him is the quality of the joyful state of mind I can automatically get into when I'm there. Mm. But when I try to cultivate that kind of state of mind in my own quiet sitting meditation, it's tougher. So probably it has a lot to do with the ambience, the fact of being next to him, the sheer kind of presence of his kind of being and his compassionate energy, whatever it may be, but there is a kind of a state of mind that I get into, quite naturally. Mm-hmm. And this is, of course, a tremendous source of energy and enthusiasm. And also, it's a constant reminder to me that, ordinary people can strive to that kind of state of mind. So that probably, for me, I find most transformative part of my work for him. But also, the other part that I've truly value is the opportunity to assist him very, very closely on some of the books that have had huge impact on the wider world. For example, his book Ethics for the New Millennium,
yes,
which is an attempt to articulate and envision what a secular approach to ethics would look like. That is an approach that is respectful to all the perspective of the multiplicity of religions, but at the same time, it does not require subscribing to any particular religious belief or faith. And that was done out of a sheer compassion by His Holiness for the world, with concern that somehow we need to promote the culture of compassion. So I had the a great opportunity to work with him closely on that. Another book that I assisted him was the book that told his story of many years of engagement with science, scientists, universe in a single atom, where, for me, the most compelling part of that book, in addition to personal stories, is the overarching theme, which is the need for taking compassion to be central in human motivation, and not forgetting that science is one among many human activities that are ultimately aimed at betterment of humanity. Mm. Somehow that ethical consideration that underlied, the whole scientific revolution in the early days must not be forgotten. Mm. And how the scientist, particularly as in the field of biogenetics, they are now creating new realities which human beings never confronted in the past, which has huge implications for the survival of the species in the world, as a whole. His appeal to the scientist to not to take these lightly, that take the ethical responsibility of what they are doing seriously. I think for me, and then just recently I finished... he finished a book that I assisted him on, which tells his story of more than 50 years of engagement with other religious traditions. Mm-hmm. And it's towards the true kinship of faiths, how the world's religions can come together. And again, here, one of the powerful chapters in that book is the argument that despite all the diversity in the doctrinal beliefs and the metaphysical idea theories underpinning those doctrinal beliefs, when it comes to the prescription of how to lead a good life, an ethical life, there is a tremendous convergence across all the major traditions. And these traditions were divided across time, across geography, across culture, across language. And all of these prescriptions, in the end, comes down to compassion. Hmm. Compassion is the foundation of, you know, moral teachings for all the old religions. And I think this is a powerful message that people in the religious world, as well as the secularist, need to heed. Because if it is, if this is true, and if we can convince ourselves that this is the foundation of all of our value system, and compassionate nature is a key aspect of our of who we are, then we will tell ourselves a different story. Mm. And if we tell ourselves a different story of who we are, then the chances are that we're going to try to act in accordance with that story. So, and I think these, I feel tremendously privileged, because as an ordinary person, I will never have a chance to have that kind of outreach to the world. But by serving him, hmm. you know, in the, for these books, I really have an opportunity to at least contribute to this process. So these are what I find, you know, deeply transformative. Yeah.
Well, Dupten Jinpa, but thank you so much.
Thank you. Yeah. It's a joy. Yeah.
Oh, this was great. Thank you.